Thank you. Be seated.
Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Black v. Dallas County Child Welfare Unit.
May it please the court, Mr. Prager will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, and Mr. Morris will present argument in rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Larry Prager from Dallas. I, along with Alan Morris, represent Teresa Black. This case deals with the interpretation of the trial court's findings of fact and conclusions of law in an action that was based upon Section 105 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code. It is important to emphasize that there has never been a finding in this case by a judge, a jury, or a master that Teresa Black has abused her children or that her children have been abused by anyone at any time, or that there was an emergency necessitating the removal of her children from her home.
But there have been some probable cause findings of some, one or more of those elements.
No, Your Honor. In addition to what I've recited, when the state approached the district judge with an application for a TRO, which would have allowed the state to keep the children longer than 24 hours, that application for TRO was denied. And I believe the essence of this case is not only that it's brought under Section 105 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, but that it is also brought under Chapter 17 of the Family Code, which allows almost unlimited discretion in a child abuse investigator to remove a child from the home. But that discretion...
What do you say Master Mary Lee Lewis decided on May the 9th?
Mary Lee Lewis decided simply to pass the case so that my client could obtain counsel. What had happened and what was revealed in the trial court's findings of fact and conclusions of law was that she printed the pass of the case, or she signed the pass on a pre-printed form, although the box that checked that there is an emergency was not checked when the pre-printed form was taken to the district judge, which is in a different building. The judge ministerially signed an order that appeared to find that an emergency existed.
Well,
however, the trial court, when this case was tried on the frivolousness case, recited in one of his findings of fact that there had never been an emergency, although it may have appeared so through a ministerial entry of an order.
Well, I don't understand ministerial entry. Was there a judicial decree on May the 9th giving the department temporary custody of this child or these children?
Yes, there was, but that was only because Teresa Black appeared the following Monday morning before a master without counsel, and the master, one of the findings of fact, recites, was not informed that this TRO was denied and that as a matter of law, the children should have been returned immediately. And what had happened is that the state showed up, and it's in the finding that the state knew the TRO had been denied, but they didn't tell the master, nor did they tell the client who appeared pro se, that she had an absolute right under the family code to the return of her children.
Why is it better to conduct a hearing on these issues with the parent present than without? Would it be better to hear the matter with the parent present?
Exactly. The family
code...
Well,
that's what happened on May the 9th.
No, Your Honor.
The parent wasn't present.
The parent was present.
Wouldn't it be better to hear the matter with the parent present than without?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the parent was present on May the 9th?
Yes, Your Honor, the parent was present. The point is, the parent was present without counsel, and the TRO had been denied, which means that the state did not have the authority to continue holding the children more than the 24-hour period. Of course, it would have been ideal if the mother of the children, who was appearing on a Monday after a weekend, could show up with counsel.
Well, when the sun went down on May the 9th, didn't the department have a court order saying it could keep custody of the children?
No.
What did it have?
It had nothing. The TRO had been denied.
On May the 9th?
On May the 9th. Well, the children were picked up on May 5th or May 6th. The next 24 hours, as required by the family code, the state must present a TRO to a district judge in order to have authority to keep the children more than 24 hours. They presented that to Judge Stamen, who denied that relief. At that point, the children, as a matter of law, were required to be returned home. What the trial judge, in a unique practice, will say, well, let's set it for an adversary hearing, which she wanted the master to hear, and that was a contested hearing under the family code, but unless they received the TRO, the children, as a matter of law, must be returned home.
And was Judge Stamen, was that the same person, same individual, who denied emergency relief, same one who signed the emergency order after the master's recommendation?
Yes. What happens is that, to use the term emergency order, is a misnomer. The TRO was brought to Judge Stamen and denied.
What's the date of that?
It was the weekend, it was May 5th. Well, they picked up May 5th. It was either the evening of May 5th or the morning of May 6th. It was within 24 hours of the removal of the children. Then, at that point, the children should have been returned home, and the judge's policy in that court would be set an adversary hearing for 10 days to see if there's anything here or get more evidence, but the children had to be returned home. The following Monday, they appear in front of a different magistrate, Mary Lee Lewis, who is that court's master, and Mary Lee Lewis is not informed that the TRO had been denied, although the trial judge, in reviewing this lawsuit, knew that the DA should have informed the master that the ex parte relief or the TRO was denied, and that our client, who was pro se, entered into a forced, an uninformed agreement to continue the case so that she could get counsel.
I'm unclear on whose authority the children were taken by the department in the first place on May the 5th. Was that by an oral order of a district judge?
No, it was not. On May 5th, and this is why I say the case must be considered in conjunction with Section 1703 of the Family Code, which allows a child welfare worker tremendous latitude. If there is a suspicion of abuse, they can take the child into custody, but they must get a TRO within 24 hours or the next working day. That was presented, it was denied, and the children didn't go back. That's the essence of this case. And even after the adversary hearing, which is a unique hearing under the Family Code, that even if the TRO is granted, it's set 14 days for the issue of temporary custody to be litigated.
So Judge Stamen, who denied the TRO, also set the matter for an adversary hearing before her own master on May the 9th. Is that correct? And the parties appeared and had the hearing.
Okay. An adversary hearing, the answer to that question is the only testimony from Judge Stamen, and she testified in this trial, is that she wanted it set for an adversary hearing. But setting it for an adversary hearing without giving a TRO means as a matter of law.
Okay, Mr. Prager, but I just want to know exactly what happened, and then I'll let you argue all you want to about the effect of it. But when the TRO was denied on May the 6th, did Judge Stamen, who denied it, put the matter over for a hearing with the mother present before her own master on the following Monday? She did or she didn't? She didn't do it?
All the record speaks to is that she suggested to the DA that it be set for an adversary hearing. I don't think she ministerially said it's going to be heard Monday morning. What she does, and this is...
And then it was heard on Monday.
Okay.
And the master made what recommendation?
The master passed the case because the client appeared and said, I need a lawyer.
And that ruling was taken to back to Judge Stanley. Is that correct?
Yes.
And what did she do?
She signed a form order that appeared to recite an emergency existed, but none existed. Okay.
I understand that that's your position, but she signed an order saying that emergency existed and what? Giving the custody to the department?
No. Setting it for an adversary here. The hearing that was held the following Monday was not an adversary hearing. The point is, we don't know what that hearing was. It was just to reset the case. In Judge Stamen's mind's eye, when she denied the TRO, the children should have been returned home, and pursuant to her policy, she wanted the state to set this 10-day contested hearing so that the issue of whether or not the state should have temporary custody could be litigated in a full adversary hearing.
The form order did recite an emergency. There was an emergency?
It recited there was an emergency. The form order, yes, just your form order or the form order recited there was an emergency, but there was none.
Well, at what point did the department have a duty to return the child in the face of that form order, which recited an emergency, there was an emergency? You're saying the department had to return the child in spite of the fact it had an order saying that there was an emergency?
Yes, because the department was present through its counsel when they approached the district judge ex parte and the TRO was denied. And that Monday morning, when they went to pass the case, as recited in the trial judge's finding, those same lawyers had knowledge that the TRO had been denied. And it is not a complicated position of law that you either get the TRO and keep the children or you don't.
We're not talking about, I don't believe Justice Cornyn was asking about May the 6th. He was asking about May the 9th.
May the 9th.
Based on that order, whether it's your position that it shouldn't have been signed or not.
Okay. The point is, the order, when the parties appeared in court, counsel for the state, and everyone announced that the case was going to be passed. And they were all aware, the order that appeared to have an emergency, that didn't get entered until later when it was just a stamped signature. The state was already on notice that they had been keeping the children illegally. And I understand your point that if there was this order and that the state had seen, the agents of the state had seen the order and it appeared to recite an emergency, then perhaps their conduct would not be as egregious. But that's only one part of the finding. The real significance of this case is that even after the contested hearing, which occurred on May 18th, where the parties brought in their witnesses, the doctors, the school teachers, and the defense of this case had to bring in witnesses at great expense that shouldn't have had to been called since there was never a TRO, there was a directed verdict there by the master. And the master said specifically the children should be returned immediately, and they weren't returned. And what we all know as a simple proposition of law, when a master's findings, when a master makes a ruling, those findings are in full force and in effect until set aside by the district judge.
So on May the 18th, the department's actions became frivolous?
No, they were frivolous again. May 18th didn't have to be held because there was never enough evidence to even get a TRO. That's undisputed. And then what happened, even though there wasn't enough evidence to get a TRO, an adversary hearing was set, which caused the citizen to spend money and time and dollars to fight that. And then after that directed verdict was obtained, they said, we're going to not follow the rule that says the master's order is in full effect until set aside by a district judge. We're going to appeal that. And in the face of an appeal from a master's ruling, that's a trial de novo. So the clients were in the position of having to litigated on a third time an expense, although there'd never been a finding either on a TRO when the case was passed or at the contested adversary hearing that there was any evidence that would require that those children not be returned.
Counsel, were the children actually returned?
They were returned the 19th of May when the in opposition, well, Judge Stainman returned the children on 19th of May when the when Teresa Black came in and affirmatively got an order seeking their return, and they were put the expense of doing that because here again, as the trial court later found, that the children should have been returned on the master's directed verdict, but they attempted to stay that order even though the government code requires master's orders to be in effect.
So during what period of time were they wrongfully held?
From the time that the TRO,
which was
the 6th of May.
The 6th until the 19th?
19th.
She was denied access to her children during all that time?
Correct.
And you were awarded $53,426.15 in attorney's fees. And can you tell me what time span those attorney's fees cover?
The time span covers from the minute the TRO was denied until the jury trial on the issue of reimbursement.
You weren't hired 1 month.
That's correct. I was hired a month later. Or I was hired on like the 19th of May.
So these attorney's
fees
No, I'm sorry. If you look at the jury's instruction, there were two counsel. When I came onto the case, there's an instruction for the days that I worked on the case and Mr. Morris worked on the case. And if you read the statement of facts in this case and you're wondering, well, why was there $50,000 worth of attorney's fees? The simple answer to that question was even a year and a half, 2 years later, after the trial judge had entered these findings of fact, the state was not authorized to pay 1 cent. We asked the representative, they said, well, your position is that these fees are unreasonable. And in fact, it was the state who asked for a jury trial on the issue of reasonableness of fees and expenses. It's my opinion that Section 105 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code doesn't allow a jury trial. It's purely the discretion of the trial judge after reviewing the case under the totality of the circumstances that he will determine, he or she will determine whether or not an action is frivolous or unreasonable or warrants a hearing on the amount of reimbursement.
So these aren't there specific findings by the jury as to the number of hours you put in on this case and Mr. Morris put in on this case and the evidence is undisputed as to your hourly rate and Mr. Morris's hourly rate and that's the figure that the jury came up with?
Yes, sir.
And didn't they also find zero for appeal to the Court of Appeals and zero for appeal if necessary up here?
Yes, Your Honor.
On what basis were you awarded attorney's fees for a period after May the 19th when the child was returned to Ms. Black?
Well, Your Honor, on May the 19th, the state asked for a trial de novo, and that case was set and dismissed. Then we asked for an immediate hearing under Section 105. At that point, the Attorney General comes in and spends over a year litigating whether or not this statute even applies to the Department of Human Services. And after those motions were dismissed, we impaneled the jury, and Judge Stainman, who was the initial court in which the case was filed, recused herself and transferred the case to Judge Gaither, who is the other presiding juvenile court.
Is there any finding of fact or conclusion of law which would hold the Department of Human Services conduct as frivolous after May the 19th when the child was returned to Ms. Black?
Well, no, there isn't.
So on what basis are attorney's fees justified after the child was returned to Ms. Black?
Well, one of the trial judge's findings is that we asked for an immediate hearing on the issue of expenses. The The answer to your question is that had the case been set, had the trial judge said, we'll have a hearing tomorrow and awarded us fees and expenses, then there wouldn't have been all these hearings for a year to determine whether or not the statute applied. Every bit of these fees, as determined by the jury, were necessary in order to bring the state to trial on this issue. They fought for over a year saying this statute, the DHS is outside of the statute.
Had Ms. Black, had the child been returned to Ms. Black promptly, as you say, it should have been, the child should have been, but DHS continued to litigate this issue after the child was returned. Is it your position you were still entitled to recover attorney's fees for the rest of the ensuing litigation?
I think that it turns on, number one, the judge's finding that the conduct of the state warranted a hearing on fees and expenses. And the fact finder must determine what's reasonable. And we think part of what's reasonable is what it takes to bring the case to trial. I mean, if you were to take the position, well, it may have been unreasonable, they may have ignored the judge's order, but we're only going to allow fees up until May 19th when the children were returned, that would emasculate this remedy because all the state would have to do is just what they did in this lawsuit, is file dilatory motions for over a year before the case is ever brought to trial. And the court is correct in the fact that the evidence of reasonableness, that's certainly one jury finding that's uncontradicted, reasonableness and the necessity. The trial judge made a decision that he was going to, in his jury instructions, break the cause of action into two or three parts. And those parts were when the child was in custody, until the action was dismissed, and what it took to bring the state to trial. I would...
Any other questions? The court is ready to hear argument from the trial.
Please, the court, Mr. Smith will present argument to the respondent.
Counsel, before you begin your argument, just picking up on this last question, is there any issue before this court of the amount of the attorney's fees?
Your Honor, I don't believe so. That was a point of error that was not reached.
So whether there are too much or too little, that's entirely outside the scope of this appeal.
We believe that there would be a remand for the Court of Appeals to address that particular point of error.
Why should there be a remand to address that if it's not preserved here?
It wasn't reached by the Court of Appeals.
It was not reached by the court.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And has there ever been a finding by any judge or court up to this day of danger to the children from child abuse?
There is the recital in the forum order that was discussed earlier. There were no requests for findings of fact or a determination by fact finder after a contested hearing to that effect.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Kerry Smith. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I'm here today representing the Texas Department of Human Services, also known as the Dallas County Child Welfare Unit. In some sense, this is almost as if we've got two cases to talk about, because there's the underlying cause of action, the suit affecting parent-child relationship, filed by the department against Ms. Black under Chapter 17 of the Family Code, and there is the Chapter 105 sanctions litigation against the state by Mrs. Black arising out of that. Now, in one sense, they're clearly related and clearly overlapped. And in another, they're somewhat different, and it might be helpful to the degree they could be segregated out.
Well, on the first case, you eventually dismissed that.
That's correct, Your Honor. And we're not here on that
statute. You have to keep these people on the hook for over a year.
No, Your Honor. The first case, the Thatcher case.
What was the date that you dismissed the child abuse case?
August 12, 1988.
And what was the date the child was? Children were first picked up.
May 6, 1988. A directed verdict was entered against the department on May the 18th, 1988. The children were returned on May the 19th, 1988. And the department voluntarily non-suited that action on August the 12th of 1988. And we're not contesting that result, and that's not before this court. We lost that case. For whatever reason, it was not successful, we didn't have enough, and we got a directed verdict entered against us.
Let me ask you some questions, counsel, regarding the law. When the trial judge initially denied the TRO under the statute, was the state at that time obligated to return the children to Ms. Black?
We contest.
Did the state have any authority to continue possession of those children when the judge denied the TRO granting them that possession?
This was in a point of error that was not reached by the Court of Appeals, Your Honor. And it was our position there that, in fact, what the court did was neither grant nor deny the TRO.
It
refused to rule. Well, when they say, come back Monday, we don't think that's a grant or a denial. It's simply a decline to rule one way or the other and tells you to come back later.
Now, the statute gives the state the authority when the court says, I'm not going to grant your TRO to give you possession of these children. Y'all come back Monday. The statute gives the state the authority to continue to possess those children.
What the statute says is to get an order the next working day unless the court, if the court is unavailable for a hearing on the first working day, then and only in that event the hearing shall be held no later than the first working day after the court becomes available.
The court was available on what, Friday?
That's certainly arguable, Your Honor. We showed up, we asked for a hearing, and the court, in our view, refused to rule at that time and said come back Monday. Now, it's our position the court, in effect, made itself unavailable when it would not rule one way or the other and said come back on Monday. It's also quite arguable there is some variance between the practice of the courts at that time in Dallas and the language of the family code. But that is, I understand it was in fact the common practice there at that time. I think it's important to note that as we are here on the 105 litigation, that the test for what would be sufficient to win on the underlying tax or suit should be, and we believe is, considerably different from what would justify sanctions in a 105 case. And we're going somewhat into the broader parameters of 105 cases than necessarily this particular case. The only other case that appears to really construe Chapter 105 and cited in the brief is Attorney General versus Johnson out of the Court of Appeals in Fort Worth in 1990. And in that case, the court adopted the deceptive trade practice analysis that this court has articulated where a defendant files a counterclaim for attorney fees on the theory that the plaintiff has filed an action in bad faith or it's groundless or for purposes of harassment. The Johnson opinion said that the arguable basis test that this court articulated for these deceptive trade practice cases was an appropriate one to use in evaluating whether or not the state's claim, underlying claim, was frivolous, unreasonable, or without foundation. And that's a little bit different question than do you have enough evidence to put on a prima facie case. This court has said in those cases in the DTPA area that the question is whether or not you had any arguable basis in law or fact for your cause of action. And we submit that that's an appropriate analysis here. Now, what the Court of Appeals opinion did in this case that's before this court was first they laid out the evidence that the department relied on in bringing the suit affecting the parent-child relationship, the underlying litigation. Now, while it's quite true those issues weren't submitted to a jury, and we didn't get a fact finding on whether or not abuse occurred in the traditional sense that you would want and you would need to win the Satcher suit. We submit that it's equally true that this is sufficient to show that we had an arguable basis for filing the lawsuit. This court, in its Donworth opinion, one of the deceptive trade practices case, said that even inadmissible evidence that you couldn't get in at the trial on the merits of the DTPA claim could be looked at to see whether or not they had an arguable basis for filing the lawsuit. And all of this that the court laid out in its opinion and its statement of facts is exactly what we looked at and what we saw and what we relied on in filing that suit.
Can you summarize what, in your opinion, is your best case for the conclusion that you had an arguable basis to file this claim, or to file the suit?
Ultimately, I believe it comes down to the fact that we did a thorough investigation, as thorough as one can do in an emergency situation. It would be contrasted to a hypothetical. DHS gets a telephone call. We suspect child abuse in this case. We go out and seize the kid and go get a court order or seek a court order and don't talk to anybody until after that to find out whether or not there's any reason to believe the phone call was true. What we did here was we went out, we interviewed the little girl, we talked to the two people at the daycare center, we had the little girl examined by a doctor, we talked to Mrs. Black, we talked to the other child, and we talked to Clay Rogers, who was the live-in boyfriend at that time. And if after that, after listening to what the children said and what the doctor said, confronting the parent and evaluating the answers, then they decided to take custody of the children, file the suit, and seek a court order. Now, we submit that as a matter of...
How long did all that process
I'm sorry?
How long did the process you just outlined?
All of that was done on the day, Thursday, May 5th, that the referral came in.
Was this TRO denied on or not granted, as you urge, on in the face of an affidavit from Dr. Prescott indicating opinion that the abrasion this child had on its labia was, in fact, caused by sexual abuse by some person?
Quite frankly, Your Honor, I'm not certain that that affidavit from the doctor was submitted on Friday. I will check and submit to the court on that, but to the best of my recollection, the caseworker stated what she believed Dr. Prescott had said or confirmed to her in her affidavit, and I think there may have been a hearsay problem that had something to do with the court not granting the order on that day.
But this was a 4-year-old child that had cerebral palsy, and in consultation with the child's teachers, there was a belief formed on the part of the teachers and then who reported it to the Department of Human Services that the child had been abused by her stepfather, whom she identified. Isn't that true?
Yes, Your Honor. That
and
is.
That's part of the, is that part of the affidavits that was submitted
yes.
for the court's consideration whether to issue this temporary restraining order or not?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the real contest was whether that had been self-inflicted somehow by the child herself or whether it had been inflicted, the injury had been inflicted by her stepfather.
Ultimately.
And that was really the decisive issue that the trial court had to decide, was it not?
In the underlying litigation?
Yes. As to whether
yes,
or not there had been sexual abuse.
Yes.
And you lost that case.
That's correct.
And it was here, the allegation is because you didn't immediately return the child that your conduct, the department's conduct was frivolous.
The trial court entered a series of fact findings, and it's our position that they are all basically going to conduct and don't go to the right legal question as we read and as the Court of Appeals read Chapter 105. What's covered?
In this case, though, the trial court didn't find that the department acted frivolously when they initially took custody of the children.
That's correct.
And they didn't find that the department acted frivolously, and they initially filed the suit affecting the parent-child relationship.
That's correct.
Where the trial court found that the department had it. It was in its failure to initially return the children and to subsequently return the children.
And that is precisely what the Court of Appeals focused in on, whether or not that type of conduct is covered by the waiver of immunity and the creation of liability contained in Chapter 105. The Court of Appeals did an analysis of the statute, and of course, since the Civil Practice and Remedies Code is a non-substantive codification, they looked at 2226B as originally filed and as amended in 1983. And it's very clear, as originally filed, it said lawsuit. And the word action came in when it was amended to include counterclaims and cross-claims. And there were three instances where the word action was used by itself instead of cause of action. It was obvious to the court in at least two of those cases it had to mean cause of action. For instance, one of them had said in an action brought by the state, and they said, well, conduct isn't brought, but lawsuits are, so it must mean lawsuit here. And they concluded that this was a waiver of immunity and a creation of liability only for the filing of a frivolous lawsuit, not for incidental conduct that an attorney or a party might engage in during the course of litigation.
In other words, the statute lets them off the hook no matter what they do, as long as there may have been some remote concept of merit for the suit.
Well, I think the court looked at what is the evil that the legislature intended to cure in writing Chapter 105. Now, there's obviously three candidates that could fall on that list, and we would submit one and a half of them are covered. There would be a case where you investigate before you file. You realize you don't have a case, but you go ahead and file it anyway. And that's probably covered. And there would be a case where you do an investigation, such as we did here, and for whatever reason, it doesn't pan out and you lose. We don't believe that that was covered. That would require a duty of clairvoyance on behalf of the state agents before they file a suit. No matter how good it looks, it's got to turn out right or you're going to be liable. And we don't read it as a strict liability statute. And the third situation would be where you don't do any investigation at all. You have no idea. You may get lucky, prove it up, and win, in which case you'll escape liability. Or you may be unlucky and find out there wasn't anything there, and if you'd have looked, you'd have known, and you may well get tagged. And we believe that that would also be covered here.
But a failure to comply with the statute, a failure to comply with the court's orders or lack of orders, that's subjection to no liability.
Well, Your Honor, we didn't say that. We're saying that it subjects one to no liability under Chapter 105, for defensive attorney fees. We've not said that they were without any remedies, that there were no civil suits on various allegations that could have been filed. In fact, we would note that they did go to the legislature in 1989 and seek a resolution granting consent to file the state on these facts. There is a copy of that in the transcript on page 63 and again on 125, I believe. So we're not saying that there's no remedy no matter how egregious the conduct of the state's agents might be. We're simply saying Chapter 105 was aimed at addressing the problem of a frivolous suit, filing without bothering to investigate, or if you already know you really have a case that you can't possibly win. And that it wasn't meant to impose a duty of clairvoyance on the state agents, where you got a case that looks good to guarantee it's going to stay good all the way through. Now, we do not concede that she was held without authority and that the court denied a TRO on May 6th. It's our position that the court refused to rule at that time. In any event, on May 9th, there was an order entered.
Well, generally, I think it's probably a generally accepted legal concept that if you seek some relief and the court declines to grant it, it's been denied.
Well, we would certainly agree if there's an order entered, but if the court simply says come back Monday, you know, it's reset. I don't know if it's even considered. If there's a hearing, there's no ruling one way or the other. It's still an open question at that point.
There's some intimation attempted here that State's counsel was less than candid before Master Lewis and Judge Stamen beginning May 9th. Would you respond to that?
Your Honor, we consider that is basically a bogus issue. That and the question of whether or not the emergency order language and that order of May 9th are both not really of primary concern here. Judge Stamen Evans testified at this ultimate Chapter 105 trial that she intended to sign an order on May 9th giving custody of the children to DHS. Her objection was she didn't like that language about an emergency order in there, but she understood it was by agreement between Ms. Black and DHS that DHS would have custody until the contested hearing. And that's in her testimony. It doesn't really matter whether that language is in there or not, and it doesn't really matter whether the master had been told that Judge Stamen wasn't happy with the affidavit if she was planning to give them an order giving them custody anyway. And that order clearly was sufficient to cloak DHS with a shield from liability under any reading of Chapter 105, even if this court concludes it does cover conduct, up until the directed verdict on May the 18th. Now, it's my understanding from the record that actually came down a little bit after 5. I believe Barbara Anderson's testimony is around 5:30 or 5:40, and that they then attempted to reach the foster parents and were not able to do so until about 10:30 that night, decided that was too late to take the children out and they would return them the next day, and in fact, on May 19th, they were. That's really the closest to conduct-related activity that can be complained about here. Our basic view of Chapter 105 is, though, that we won when the trial court found that the lawsuit wasn't frivolous when we filed it.
Any other questions? Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Alan Morris from Dallas, Texas. To pick up some of the questions the Justice has asked, we'll submit that the children were picked up on May the 5th by the Department. On May the 6th, a application for TRO was presented to Judge Stamen. It contained an affidavit of the caseworker, Barbara Anderson, in which she quotes the doctor's testimony. Judge Stamen, at that time, based on that affidavit, said, I'm going to refuse to grant the TRO. I'm going to pass it over to Monday. You can present evidence of Dr. Prescott or anything else you have on Monday. Mrs. Black appeared in person without an attorney. At that time, there was a finding that the state didn't have any other evidence. And Judge Mary Lee Lewis, or referee Mary Lee Lewis, signed a form order passing the case over for an adversarial hearing. When Mrs. Black hired an attorney, me, and I go to the court's file, I'm seeing an order valid on its face finding an emergency. Judge Stamen didn't make a docket entry when she denied the TRO. And then we had an adversary hearing on May the 18th in which Mary Lee Lewis, after hearing Dr. Prescott testify, denied the state's motion and ordered the children returned. And rather than, as the Attorney General's office would have you believe, that they returned them the next day, they didn't. The state filed a stay order to stay Mary Lee Lewis's order and prevent them from having to deliver the children. Then after that stay order was denied, the department returned the children.
On the same day?
The day after the adversarial hearing, the same day. Yes, that's right, Your Honor. And as to attorney's fees that Judge Hecht asked about, yes, we're entitled to attorney's fees after the children were returned. Yes, we're entitled to attorney's fees after they dismissed their action in August. Because we were faced with a catch-22 situation. If on August the 18th or on May the 19th when they returned the children, they'd say, here, Mr. Morris, Mr. Frager, we'll pay you your attorney's fees up to this day, then we'd have gone on about our business. Or after they dismissed the case in August, we'd have gone on about our business. But they didn't. They fought us at every avenue. They wouldn't pay us anything. They said they weren't within the purview of the statute. There were all kinds of exceptions that apply. And we maintain to your honors that we're entitled to attorney's fees up to and including that moment in time that we got a judicial declaration that of what reasonable attorney's fees were necessary and that they were obligated to pay. Because up until that time, they hadn't tendered us a penny. So to answer that question, yes, we're entitled up to, we got the jury verdict.
Let me see if I understand you correctly.
Yes, sir.
See, the trial court did find that the wind file, that the lawsuit was not frivolous.
Yes, sir.
Suit affecting child parent relationship. You're saying that once the master entered her finding in order denying the state its relief on what May 8th?
Yes, sir.
That at that point, there, when they sought to stay, at that point it became frivolous. When they continued to pursue, when did it become frivolous?
We maintain it became frivolous when the TRO was denied by Judge Stamen and they didn't return the children. It was still frivolous, yes, sir. And it was still frivolous that following Monday when they didn't tell my client, who was unrepresented by counsel, we don't have any authority to hold your children. We should return your children. But instead, she says she wants to get a lawyer, and they say, well, here, sign this agreed order. And we'll pass the case to let you get an order. At that point in time, it was frivolous. Up till we had the adversarial hearing, it was frivolous, because after I entered my appearance as her attorney of record, no one said that the TRO was denied. We didn't have an adversarial hearing before Mary Lee Lewis. We didn't offer any new evidence. It was still frivolous. It was frivolous up until the time, it was frivolous on the 18th when they didn't return the children after there was a ruling by Mary Lee Lewis that they should, and they agreed in open court. And unfortunately, there's not a record in Dallas County of these referees in the juvenile court. We don't have a record, so we don't have a record of that hearing.
They don't have court reporters?
They didn't at that time, no, sir. They do now, and I think it's a result of this case. It was frivolous. It was frivolous when they filed the stay order. It was frivolous when they filed their de novo appeal. It was later denied. And it was frivolous up until the time we had the jury verdict. The caseworker, you'll see in the record, still would not admit that there was no sexual abuse in this case, although there was no judicial finding at all. So to answer your question, yes, sir, we're maintaining it was frivolous from the time the TRO was denied up until we had the jury verdict.
How can the action, if it's not the conduct that's the focus?
I beg your pardon?
If it's not the conduct that's the focus, but the action, the cause of action, the allegations that are being made, how can they be frivolous if a district judge signs an order giving the department custody, whether rightly or wrong? How can it be frivolous from the day Judge Stamen signed that order until the master ruled otherwise?
Well, I believe, but the order was valid on its face. I don't quarrel that. But I think it was frivolous, and I think Judge Gaither found it was frivolous in that they concealed facts from the master that Judge Stamen had the previous Friday denied the TRO, and that they didn't tell the mother. The order was valid on its face, if that's what you're asking me, yes. But we are still contending it was the actions of the agency were frivolous, even though they had an order valid on its face.
So you can win and still be frivolous?
Yes, sir. Lastly, we would respectfully... It is? Okay, thank you very much.
No, if somebody asked you a question...
Oh, I'm sorry, I said my time was up.
The judge asked you if you can win and still be frivolous, and you said yes, and I infer from that, based on your previous remarks, you can win and it'd still be frivolous if you win by deception or deceit.
We did.
No, I'm talking about the deception.
Oh, I misunderstood the question. I apologize. I thought he meant that we win and the action would be frivolous. And we did. That was the facts of this case.
I think you better. No, he may want to clarify.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Because one of us misunderstood him.
Okay.
It was Judge Gantz.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes the argument. In the second call, we'll take another brief recess.
Please rise.